Session number 17825, Reel 4.
Mr. McGovern, Reel 4.
We were unaware of the true extent of our losses initially because your knowledge was basically restricted to the losses that you'd sustained on your own station. For general information, one relied entirely on the newspapers or the radio. And I think it was possibly 24 hours later when the extent of the losses were made known. And I don't think at that time that even then the true extent was stipulated. I think it was simply said that the RAF had fairly heavy losses.
Did you ever come across anybody with low morale whilst you were doing operations?
I can't recall running into anyone who said, "This is it, I can't continue, I've got to go." I think I'm right in saying that morale generally was such that after we'd had a difficult target, we would probably find that the next one would be relatively easy, or that we would do some practice flying, which would take your mind away from the earlier experience. But by this time, we were becoming a fairly experienced crew, I think, and were somewhat nonchalant about people who got the chop, as we called it at that time. And there was this attitude of self-preservation which, oh, it's almost wrong for me to say it, but I think I'm right in saying that if someone else was shot down, you felt that you were glad it was them and not you. And it's an extremely selfish attitude, but nevertheless it is one that did prevail at the time. And I won't deny it.
Now, after Nuremberg, your operations take a different turn because in April 1944 you turn your attention mainly to France and the preparations for D-Day.
Quite true.
Can you tell me about what sticks in your mind about the operations for that period, please?
Yes, I think the next episode was one that seemed to be split between the necessity for the preparations for D-Day, although we were unaware of the fact at the time, and the necessity to control the dispatch of these buzz bombs, the V1s and V2s, V1s particularly, and the attacks on the London area. And so we would often be called at short notice when our powers that be were informed of the location of one of these sites. We would be bombed up and off within a couple of hours to attack that particular target, sometimes during the day, sometimes at night. But the big morale booster that we had at this time was that we had the advantage of fighter cover on daylight operations, and that our aircraft had the H2S removed and a mid-undergun put into a manually 0.5 mid-undergun fixed centrally to give some protection from underneath, and I think that gave an air of confidence too. So all in all, we looked on that as a relatively easy period and felt that, you know, life was generally becoming much more tenable, particularly after having started our operations, anticipating a life that consisted of Ruhr Valley, Hamburg, Berlin, and that sort of attack for the rest of your existence in the Ulm squadron. So this was relatively light work. And one of the outstanding experiences I can recall of that time was making an attack. First of all, D-Day itself, we were off at something like 2 o'clock in the morning to assist the invasion forces by taking out a heavy anti-aircraft battery that was potentially dangerous towards our landing forces and the airborne forces. And we also, I think, did an attack on coastal defences.
Yes, you put 5th of June, heavy coastal defences at Mulga. By the look of it, or Ulga, right?
Hulga, H-O-U-L-G-A-T. Hulga, that's right.
Any particular memories of that attack?
Except that it was a particularly easy one. We'd looked on this as, you know, luxury flying in those days because they were relatively short trips, only about 4 hours. Very often in daylight, even at night, they were not particularly heavily defended. We didn't have deep penetration raids to do, and life was much more tenable. But I was going to mention one particular event where I think we did 2 trips on D-Day, one in the morning and one round about midnight again. But there was one attack that we made on a road and rail bridge at a place called Coutances. And there we were ordered to attack from 1,800 feet, which was quite low for, you know, from our experience. And I had this unpleasant experience of seeing just above me another Halifax, bomb doors agape, only about 50 feet above us. I could see every bomb and every rivet in the fuselage, slowly, slowly approaching from our starboard side to sit squarely above us. And I thought, if we reach the aiming point at the same time, we're going to be in a most unpleasant set of circumstances. However, having reported this to the skipper, he managed to jink to one side, and we made our bombing on a slightly different heading, and the anticipated risk was minimised quite considerably. It's the only time that I can ever remember seeing the compression waves, the rings of compression waves, running out from the various bomb bursts. Anyway, apparently that attack was quite successful. We were of assistance to the forces. I can remember on another occasion we made an attack on Caen in support of the invasion forces. And I think we were much criticised afterwards for the mess that we made, insofar as we took out the target all right, which we were told at the time was a steelworks on the banks of a canal into which the Germans had fortified quite heavily with anti-tank weapons and weapons of one kind and another, and were making life quite difficult for the army in their advance. However, we took the place out, and from what I can recall of it, we simply left a quite appalling clouds of dust and smoke in our wake. And the army were then complaining that we made life even more difficult because the roads that they'd intended to follow were simply strewn with rubble and all sorts of rubbish that they had to circumnavigate the place.
Yes, the attack on Coutances was actually on D-Day itself.
Was it really?
Caen came a bit later.
Right.
You had swapped from Halifax's from Lancaster's to Halifax.
To Halifax 3, 3s and then on to 7s.
What did you think of the Halifax as compared with the Lancaster?
Initially, there was some resentment, but afterwards, I found that they were quite as good an aircraft as the Lancaster. There's no doubt at all, because we were still flying on the same kinds of motors, so therefore we had no comparison to make with the Merlin engines, which I think is the comparison that's often made with Bomber Command crews.
And the Army support operation at Caen, I found, is 18th of July.
Is it in July? Right.
You were still with the same squadron, were you?
Yes, indeed. I had been given a temporary posting to one of the other squadrons. What squadron number was that now?
438, was it?
No. It was 432, I think. 432 squadron, that's right, at Eastmoor. I don't know why we were sent there. I think probably as a morale booster. But they'd had rather a rough time, and they wanted a couple of experienced crews. We simply flew across there. We were across for about a week. I don't know whether I did one or two trips with them. And then we came back to Linton on Ouse. Strange way of doing things, but however, the powers that be must have had the reasons for so doing.
Any other memories of raids in this final period of activity that you had?
I suppose they'll come back to me when you've gone home.
Because I think you finished operations in July, was it? 1944?
August, I think. August.
What did you think of going on daylight raids as opposed to night?
Initially with some trepidation, but one sort of got used to it, and it was quite pleasant to be flying in daylight, to tell you the truth, particularly once you were assured that you were going to have adequate fighter cover. And I can remember being escorted back from one trip with a couple of Mustangs who were dancing attendance on us, generally, you know, being very, very friendly with the waggle of wings, letting us know that they were there should they be needed. Quite a comforting sight.
Your last raid, according to the logbook, was 5th of August. Supply depot in tunnels on the Paris area, it says.
Yes. That was a fairly heavily defended target. There were some German supplies, I think probably V1 or V2 supplies, in tunnels somewhere, I think, not too far from Paris. And I suppose we were getting rather blasé by that time, and relatively light flak was the thing to be expected, and something that we didn't particularly respect.
How many operations did you do altogether, do you think?
39.
More than a tour?
Yes. I think, generally speaking, after I'd been wounded, the Canadians considered me to be first tour expired. I think it was their practice to send people home who had been in such circumstances. And I think their thinking was quite liberal towards me, because in my commendation they refer to a second tour. But I don't consider it to have been the second tour, simply a continuation of the first tour.
We haven't emphasised, I think, that the Euro squadron was a Canadian squadron.
It was a Canadian squadron, yes. 426 squadron, based in 6th Group, at Linton-on-Ouse, which is a station that's still operating as a training unit.
What condition were you in by the time you finished ops?
I can't recall being any different than initially on joining the squadron, because whilst I went in and after my first raid became extremely frightened, of course, And I can remember in those early days when we went to our briefing and the curtain went back over the map of Europe, we saw the red tape spread out and we saw the potential hazards and the length of the journey. The butterflies were in your tummy. You settled down for a little while after that as you had your flying meal. And the worst time again then was waiting outside the aircraft, getting ready to board. But then once you got settled down into your routine, you were able to relax a little, at least on the outward leg. Until you were leaving British shores, at which point then it was tension again for anything up to 6 hours.
What are your feelings today in 1998 about having taken part in the war?
I'm glad that it was an experience to have gone through. I'm glad that I survived. But I hope I'm able to empathise with RAF people now who took part in the Gulf campaign and to appreciate how they must have felt when they were flying operationally. But I'm glad it's an experience that I took.
If there's time, if we could just read a poem that you've got in your scrapbook here about the rear gunner, and if you can tell me to what extent this applied to you. Can I just read it quickly?
Surely.
I feared for him, his mind, what he saw hurtling backwards to his private war. He could spare only a fleeting thought for the enemy in the city staring up or hiding from the sound of a thousand Merlins circling round. When he glanced down into the targets of molten lead, incinerating the living or dead, suspended 4 miles high in fear and cold, it was retaliation, he'd been told. What words descriptive enough to tell of a comradeship in hell, or explain what the torment was like to have come again, 8 hours or more as an age on age, with only a perspex capsule for a stage, as his friends torn asunder in the tortured air, to know only roundabout the dank grey clouds as shrouds. On return to base, he couldn't grieve, or a quiet moment spend, or really quite believe the absence of a particular friend from another crew who only yesterday he knew. In any case, it wasn't done. There are no ops tonight, an evening out instead. Maybe only a 24-hour future lies ahead. Drink too many beers, dance, find a girl, laugh, sing anything to hide that inner mind already dead. At times, his face told of a recent leave, normality to retrace. Not this hideous make-believe, this stark, unreal contrast to home, where there was sameness, nothing rearranged. In the sudden quietness of his room, staring dreadful at the papered wall in his own bed curled, sheltered briefly from that other world, trying the everyday things to recall. Down the lane, the old stone school, village tea shops, bright awnings, steadfast chapel, boys' brigade. And breakfast on slow Sunday mornings. The war took its course, he older but young in years, still has no tears. I feared for him more then for what he saw, now lies deep unanswered in his eyes. Some evenings in the village inn at times he hears the idle talk begin, and at the outside of the crowd he quietly leaves and has to be alone, hardly speaking, yet not proud, not feeling better than they, because he had hardly anything to say. As he walks, his mind still wanders, and in so many different ways, living in the memory of their living days. Does any of that strike a chord with you as a depiction of what aircrew felt in Bomber Command during the war?
Yes, I think that very definitely I can remember the return home on leave and feeling the comfort of what they there describe as normality. But I don't know, the solace, if you like, of finding things are still as you remember them. The old school, the streets, the dance halls. Not that I frequented dance halls greatly, but just simply as part of the locality. The public houses and friends that one would meet from what seemed an age ago. And I particularly find that appropriate now in the last verse of the poem that says, I value my solitude, my peace and quiet. And I get quite irritable sometimes when it's disturbed. Now, whether I'm just a bad-tempered old man or what, I'm not quite sure.
But when he uses words like a comradeship in hell and what the torment was like to have to come again, is that true?
I'm afraid.
An exaggeration?
No, I don't think it's any exaggeration. I think I did mention earlier that when one went into the briefing room and we saw the target displayed for the first time and the route you were to follow, the distance, particularly, I'm talking about the deep penetration raids now, of course, and the apprehension that would go with that, which lessened as we talked about it between the crew, or it'll be easy, you know, we'll manage it, we've done it before, this attitude. And you would go for your flying meal, and you might be able to get a little rest, or you might not. And then I found that the tension rose for me in that few minutes which there inevitably were prior to climbing aboard the aircraft. You'd be sitting out there smoking your cigarette and having a last emptying of the bladder before climbing aboard. And then you started to busy yourself. The next moment of apprehension was on takeoff, because takeoff time was, well, for me, always a time of tension. You realised how vulnerable you were, particularly with a heavily loaded aircraft, anything up to 2,000 gallons of fuel and, I don't know, 6,000 pounds, 7,000 pounds of bombs aboard, all dependent on those engines keep on driving those big fans at the front and getting you airborne. And then we got those times for takeoff when, because of the wind direction, you had to use the short runway. I don't know if you've heard this referred to before, but very often the prevailing wind on the airfield had its long runway, but there were occasions when, due to wind change, you had to take off using the shorter runway, which sort of was anything up to 500 yards shorter than the normal runway. And getting airborne under those circumstances is very often a tense time. But after that, you settled down and waited for the big moment when you cross the enemy coast. Sometimes you'd be welcomed by some light flak, sometimes you wouldn't, and then the tension then increased again all the time. Total darkness in the majority of cases, not knowing what lay just beyond you, the range of your vision. But then it would all flow away on your return to base, and you were glad to be back, and your mind went, I suppose, in to a more relaxed attitude, which I suppose must have had some sort of healing properties.
Have you ever had nightmares about raids since the war?
Initially, yes, I did. After leaving the forces particularly, I don't know what should occur then, but one of my worst worries has been this feeling of guilt and over the fact that Tom Hastings was killed in my place, and I felt that I should have been fit, and in my own mind was fit to fly, but Tom Hastings died instead.
Just on a lighter thing, you mentioned emptying your bladder before you left. Somebody once told me that the custom was to urinate on the tyres.
That was the usual thing, but only because it was easier to do it out there. But it's quite true that it was all. We had lots of silly superstitions. One would always try to wear the same flying clothing. This sort of nonsense. If you had a particular good luck charm, you would ensure that you had it with you at all times. But, you know, as one sits back now in the cold light of day with reflection, we see what silly, well, what's the word I'm looking for? Silly bits of mind juggling they were. Superstition is the word I'm looking for. One other thing that has bothered me, and it worried me for some time, was my inability to get to see the graves of Freddie Stewart and the rest of the first crew. I don't know why that should upset me, but I've always felt that there was some psychological urge to do that. Perhaps one day I will.